Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson. A new biography is being written on Claude Graham White, one that will give much more depth, we hope, to the story behind the man who was a British aviation legend in his time, and one who's sadly downtrodden and outcast by the government of the day. Joining me is Alison White, who has taken on the task of correcting the historical record and resetting our perception of the man. Alison, welcome to Extended.
Much. Very happy to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Tell us your relationship to Claude Graham White and the background to this book.
So when I was quite young, I was growing up, my mother happened to mention that we had a famous aviator relative. And she said that it was my father's great uncle. I don't think he is, but we were related. And he was famous for some kind of race, something to do with the Daily Mail, and he flew at night. And that was kind of it. And then many, many years later, I'm a mother myself. And because my father joined the RAF, inspired by Claude, by the way, and my brother was named Graham after him, we had computers quite early on in our house. And so come the sort of 1990s, when the internet's there and people start to have home computers, it's much more ubiquitous, I start to look up our family thinking, oh, let me just look at genealogy. It's kind of interesting. And then think to myself, oh, I'll look up this Graham White character. That's how much I knew about him. I thought his name was Graham. And of course, it's not. And I discover that. And I also discover that he lost the race. So he didn't even win it. And then I start to sort of notice other things. And I dip in and out of the subject for really, I guess, probably 15 years. And I pick up things as I go along and I start to think, gosh, this guy's really interesting. And eventually, during this period, I had lost touch with my father. He'd got married again and moved to another country, and we hadn't been communicating for 2 decades. So by accident, he got back into my life at the beginning of last year. And I suppose it was that and the thought of family that made me think, do you know what, I've got all this stuff I've collated. I really should turn it into a book. And so in July 2023, I thought I'm going to broadcast it to all my friends because that way I'll have to do it. I'm going to tell everybody. And literally a year ago, I say, right, I'm going to write this book. And I don't know how long it's going to take, but here I am a year later and I've written about 85,000 words, nearly finished, done a lot of research. And now I have a publishing contract. I've got the backing of the RAF Museum. So that's the background. And I still don't know how I'm really related. But I would say this one thing, that when I look at pictures of Claude and expressions that he pulls, it's my father and my brother. And even his brother, he's very dark and my father's very dark. So there's definitely a relation. And that is another part of the book, but I've not tackled that bit yet. But nevertheless, I'm so passionate about the subject now and right. Feel that I know quite a lot about it, actually.
Let me come back to Claude then in a tiny second. I just want to ask you a question about you're not an author by trade. You told us a little bit about your aviation background, but how does one come to giving up a career in a very professional sector to focus on something like this? And how do you go about researching such an in-depth issue as Claude Graham White?
Good question. I'm actually a trained lawyer by background, and I've worked in-house legal advisor for many, many years for a number of family businesses, actually. And lately I've been working for a company that works within the aerospace sector. So I actually do have a 9-to-5 job. As a lawyer, you are used to writing, taking a lot of information and disseminating that down in a way that your client understands what you're talking about. And I think that I am a bit unorthodox as an author of this type of book because I'm not an aviation expert by any means. But I am an aviation enthusiast now because I've really had to educate myself.
Welcome to the team.
Yes. And right. I've got the support of some experts to make sure that I don't make a boo-boo, because I am very committed to this being an authoritative book on him, but also one that tells a story that is maybe wider than most people look at, and which actually has allowed me to make some links that maybe people haven't made about him before, which is kind of interesting.
Okay, so let's try and learn a bit more about Claude Graham White, and where did he come from? Why was he so important to the industry? How did aviation come into his life?
His family's from Hampshire, from a long line of Whites. His father and his grandfather before him had a property auctioneer's business, and his grandfather was twice the mayor of Southampton, and he was also the high sheriff. So he's a man that gave himself to public service. The father of Claude, not so much. Sounds like he had a nice time with all the money that they had. So they were pretty well off, and property owners. And so Claude's upbringing was very much English countryside. They lived in a place called Burselden, just outside Southampton, in a lovely big house in the middle of the countryside, and spent the summers in the Isle of Wight. Claude was a lifelong lover of the sea, as was his father. He sailed lots of yachts and were members of the yachting club there at Cowes. And he was brought up by a number of governesses, learned to speak French and German, certainly French. He was a fluent speaker. He was the youngest of three siblings, elder sister, Beatrice, and his brother was Montague, and then there's Claude. And they seem to be a little bit of a family who at the time, maybe this is for the time quite usual, but there was sort of slightly social climbing, all of them. They hyphenated the name when the boys went to school. Very English upbringing. He talks about reading Penny Dreadfuls, and, you know, he was a typical boy, really, I think.
And just for context, Alison, sorry, one of the questions I should have asked you is, when was this, in context of time, when was this?
He was born in 1879.
Right, okay.
So, yeah, that's a part of Queen Victoria's reign.
Right,
and, you know, we're in the middle of a big empire and Britain's very powerful, and obviously the Boer War hasn't started yet, so that's the sort of time, yeah.
Okay, so how did aviation come into his life? I'm thinking about the turn of the century, the Wright brothers' first flight, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, so I wanted to know this as well, because I thought, why engineering? Where's this engineering thing come from? And a lot of people, when they talk about Claude, they sort of level the accusation of him. He's not really an engineer, is he? And actually, the clue I found was in the archives of Bedford Grammar, which was the senior school he went to age 13 with his brother in 1892. It was situated in Bedford, and it was at the time under the control of a head teacher, Philpotts, who came from Rugby, and he was quite modern. And there was a head of trustees of the school who was from the Whitbread family, and there were a number of kind of, I'd say, quite practical parents on the board of trustees. And they were saying, well, look, why are we teaching our sons Greek and Latin? Like, how does that serve them? They're either going to go, as you know, join the empire, or they're going to go and join the army and be in the cavalry. How does that help? And so they decide to build this series of workshops that become very successful. First a woodworking workshop, and then a saddlery workshop, which makes sense. If you're in the cavalry, you can fix your equipment on the hoof, so to speak. But then they raise a lot of money and they build these incredibly impressive engineering workshops, which is a little unusual for that school. Although, you know, that's the kind of thing that would normally be dealt with by companies or in technical schools. This is a grammar school, and they've got some incredible equipment in there: steam turbines, electrical plant, lathing machines, milling machines. And Claude and his brother become absolutely fascinated. Claude definitely neglects his studies, and he's there all the time. And age 14, decides to rewire his parents' house with electricity. Now, nobody has electricity at that point, and very few people. And he's only discovered when he sort of almost falls through the ceiling and demolishes the ceiling So he's got this precocious interest in it. And by the time he leaves school, age 16, he's done 3 years of solid engineering, to the extent that it's, you know, he's been to see engineering companies. They take him on day trips. He joins, becomes an apprentice engineer. And at that point, his goal is to become a motor engineer. He's fascinated by motor vehicles. And the year after he leaves school in 1896, he buys a car, a Bolle. And just to put that into context, in 1895, there are about 14 or 15 cars in the whole of England. 1896 is probably less than 100, and he has one of them. So, you know, he's this really precocious character, and you don't buy a car unless you know how to handle it. As Charles Reynolds says, you know, you have to get up 2 hours before you're going anywhere to actually get the thing started. So that's where his passion for motor engineering starts, is in motor racing, and he builds his first bike and stuff like that. He's a bit of a speed freak as well, it turns out later, because before he's really famous and in the newspapers for that fame, he's in the newspapers quite frequently for speeding offences up until, you know, and he's described as a speed merchant. And that continues literally for the rest of his life. He's constantly being caught out speeding. So he's a bit of a character,
So aviation becomes a hot topic at that time. Obviously, we can't look back and see exactly how he discovered it. But very, very soon after the first powered flight, he got involved in aviation quite quickly, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he was involved in ballooning, and he was actually one of the founder members of the Aero Club. And I think he, like Charles Rolls, he found ballooning incredibly frustrating. I think Claude was a bit of a control freak, and he just didn't like the idea that you got wafted away and then you just sort of land in a field and have to find a train to get your balloon back. So he soon got rid of his ballooning equipment. But he was a little bit slow on the uptake of aviation, I think, because in 1906, you've got the Santos-Dumont flight in Europe, and that makes a great deal of a splash. And that's the point at which the Daily Mail put forward their £2,000 challenge, which is the London to Manchester challenge. And that just shows you how long it goes unclaimed, actually.
Yeah.
And then Claude, I think he was, at this point, he's got a motor company. So he's going to France quite frequently to pick up cars. And he's a French speaker as well. And I think he sort of, while he's there, he decides to go to see the flying meet in 1908, where Wilbur Wright shows the French, this is how you turn an aircraft, and is probably impressed by that. But it's not until Reims the following year that he goes and actually buys an aircraft from Blériot, which Blériot then proceeds to trash and crash.
Right, okay.
Notoriously bad, accident-prone pilot. I don't know how he got across the channel, to be honest.
Right.
So he then says to Blériot, look, you've smashed my eye. My plane, I'd like one, another one, please. But here's the condition of me being nice about it. I want to go and work in the factory and see it being built and help it to be built. And originally, Blériot's against that because that's his intellectual property. But he does allow it eventually, and Claude gets his aircraft, which is the Blériot 12, very unstable, incredibly difficult aircraft to fly, monoplane.
Yeah. Now, I've read a little bit about in your draft of the book, that very first flight. Do you just want to share with us some of the experiences he had? Because he didn't seem very afraid, did he? You know, that speed, that thrill, that energy didn't put him off anything. Do you tell us how he first got to that first flight?
Yeah, so he goes to his plane is delivered to Issy. Le Molino, and that's a little flying field. It's not the one that Blériot used, which is at Pau, but it's obviously a field where they've delivered this plane. And he goes with a friend, and he's waiting for people to turn up to sort of show him out the ropes, really. And they don't turn up, and he's sort of impatient, he's quite impetuous, really, and decides he's going to have a go at flying it himself with his mate. And at this point, you know, it normally takes about six people to launch an aircraft. So they've got to drag it out. They're very heavy. They've got to hold on to it, otherwise it will tip over. But him and his mate drag it out. They tie the tail to a fence. And he goes around the front and sort of starts the propeller off. And it, because there's slack in the rope, it sort of leaps forward and nearly kills him. He then leaps on the aircraft and tells his mate to sort of, you know, let go, let the rope go. And then his mate has to run after it and jump on himself. And he's probably at this point thinking, what the hell are we doing? And Claude sort of learns quite quickly that as he's sort of taxiing across this field, that without speed, these aircraft are not very steerable. You do need speed for them to be manoeuvrable, and they're hurtling towards a stone wall. It's actually a lot closer than they realised it was at the beginning. And so his poor mate has to get out and act as a bit of a sea break and stop the plane. And then they turn around and they have a few goes going up and down. And then eventually Claude says, well, it's supposed to fly. Let's have a go. And using his knowledge of having seen and observed people flying, sort of sets the throttle where he thinks it should be and takes off. And it's clearly a natural. And I think some of what that comes from is he was a very, very talented sailor. And unlike a lot of people, he appreciated that the air carries currents, air currents and pressure, much like water does. And I think he had an innate understanding of that. And that's what allowed him to really be the flyer he was. And so they turn up, eventually he panics, the mechanics turn up and they see him flying around. They're like, how the hell did he get up there? And that's one thing to get up, how are you going to get down? And he does sort of show this natural ability to understand engines from his motoring background, like a lot of aviators. And land safely, and Blériot sort of nearly has a heart attack because it's obviously not good PR if somebody dies on his first flight in his aircraft, and says to him, look, firstly, you know, you need to be at a better field. You've got to come to power, and I will get, we'll give you some proper lessons. And that's actually what happens. And there is an unattributed photo that I discovered of him on the day he actually gets his pilot's license from Blériot. The time somebody's handing him a bunch of violets, say, congratulations, you've done it, you know, you've got your license, which was number 30, and that's in December 1909.
Okay, so he goes on to, I think it's fair to say, quite an extraordinary amount of flying in the next year or two. But he then, we mentioned the London to Manchester air race and that amazing amount of money that was put up. He decided to go for that, didn't he? Tell us a little bit about that story, because it's quite fascinating from a lot of aspects.
Yeah, so I mean, it's kind of extraordinary because he's such a novice pilot. He's not really done any cross-country flying at this point at all. The most significant piece he does is when he decides that the aircraft that he needs for this is a Farman. And he goes across to France to Farman's factory. And Farman says, well, I'll let you have an aircraft, but you want to, you know, you need to prove to me that you can fly it. And he sort of is shown how to maneuver it and picks it up really quickly and is up flying around very quickly and flying for an hour. And at that point, there's probably less than 50 people in the entire world who have flown for longer than an hour. It's so, so significant. And Farman's like really impressed by him. And he's so confident, he takes his mother up for a flight as well. She's paid for the plane, and she becomes thus the first English woman to ever be a passenger in an aircraft. So gutsy lady. He then, the plane comes back to the UK, to England, and this is now April 1910. So he's really only been a flyer for sort of less than 5-6 months. And he's going, yes, I'm going to do this flight, which would be a new English record. And the only person who's done any significant long-term flying is Farman, and then Paulhan, who becomes his competitor, but not at the first attempt. So this wasn't a race, this was a challenge. And so Claude serves his notice on the Daily Mail. He has a bit of hoo-ha about where he's going to take off. The government's still not taking aviation very seriously. They're like, no, you can't use Woolwich Arsenal. Who are you? And I think everybody really does expect him to fail. And he takes off from Park Royal on the 23rd of April, very early in the morning. There's hardly anybody there. The Aero Club are there to sort of make sure it's all fits in, and off he goes. And he flies a considerable amount with one stop, and then he has to land because of problems with his engine. But by this point, he's done 115 miles, which is a new English record. And it's the longest he's ever flown. And by some sad set of circumstances, he realises I'm not going to be able to do it within the rules within 24 hours, so I'll do a reverse. I'll do it from Manchester to London. And in the meantime, unfortunately, his plane is damaged because it's not tied down and wind tips it up. So that's it. So he's like, okay, and he's so close at that point. But of course, having done this, he's suddenly, people are like, this guy's in with a chance, and it suddenly starts to become very newsworthy. And probably the French hear about it at this point and go, hang on a minute, we could do this. And then it becomes a race between him and Paul Pan.
Right.
And so he goes rushing back to London to fix his aircraft. Paul Pan, in the meantime, is traveled across from France and is now having to put together his aircraft. And it really is a race to see who's going to be first. But they do have a gentleman's agreement that they will let the other one know when they set off, so that it is truly a race. But that doesn't happen, and Paul Han gets off at least an hour earlier than Claude, so it's not a race. Claude gets woken up. He then gets up, takes off at about 6:30 of an evening. Paul Han's well ahead of him by now, and when Paul Han lands for the night and goes to sleep, this is the point at which Claude makes the audacious choice of, I'm going to fly through the night to catch up with him.
Wow.
And he gets all his mates to, with their cars, to point their headlamps at the extent of the field that he's done his first stop in, and takes off, knocks off his throttle. So turns his engine off inadvertently with his sleeve, and then realizes and turns it back on again, which in itself was pretty dodgy. And, yeah, and flies and flies for as long as he can by moonlight. But eventually at about 4:17, he has to sort of say, well, I've done as much as I can. But he's caught up with Paul Han, is only 15 minutes away from Paul Han. And Paul Han discovers this, gets up, takes off himself a few minutes ahead of Claude landing, within about, I think he's about 12 miles away from him at this point. So in the meantime, in France, they've got this full-blown map of the race at the Place de l'Opéra with representations of where they are on the routes. So it's really gone viral, if you like to say. And then a little while after Claude has arrived at his first stop near Lichfield, his mother turns up in the Daily Mail car and says, oh, I'm so sorry. And at that point, he realises that Paul Han has arrived in Manchester and has won. And he then does the second thing, which really turns this whole escapade into what's called a glorious failure. He stands on the car and he says, three cheers for Paul Han. He really is the greatest aviator there ever was.
Yeah.
And because of his, and he also says, I've never had £10,000, so I don't miss what I never had. And in doing that, he becomes as famous as Paul Han, perhaps even more so, really, in his attitude and just the plucky, daring do. And he's very sort of charming and he's good looking. So he's like good newspaper fodder. And you know, that makes him equally as famous.
Did you know that the RP-3 rocket projectile, used to great effect by Hawker Typhoons in the tank-busting ground attack role, was originally conceived as an air-to-air weapon to attack Luftwaffe bomber streams? Did you also know that in the 1950s, an indigenous light aircraft built in the Philippines was skinned with woven bamboo matting? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal, print and digital, that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
G'day, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran from Plane Crazy Down Under.
And you're listening to Extended.
That's the springboard for this personality that then becomes, I suppose, of his time, an influencer, a famous TV star, a film star, however we want to describe it. In the media of the day, he became quite a personality, didn't he? And that allowed him to go on and start displaying and doing events and things like that, which is where he becomes so much more well-known.
So he's really in demand all summer 1910. He does a number of different flying events, very present to the fact that they are taking their lives in their hands. Obviously, Charles Rolls dies that summer. And Claude he's very logical in his approach to things. He's not a risk taker, but he does very risky things. So he de-risks himself, and he's in huge demand. And Harvard University have been planning an aviation meet to compete with Los Angeles. And they're saying, we want one on the Eastern Board. And they really go to town on this aviation meet. And they pay Claude a lot of money to come over and appear. And really, America is a huge turning point for him as well, because it allows him to accumulate an enormous amount of money in prize money, because he completely dominates the Americans at Harvard. He wins pretty much all the prizes. He wins a very big prize from the Boston Globe, which is to fly out to the Boston Lighthouse and back twice. None of the other aviators, not even Curtis, even bother to attempt it. They're like, there's no point. We're not going to beat that. And he's just really smart. He takes two aircraft with him to America, one for speed and maneuverability, which is the Blériot with a 70 horsepower Newport engine, very fast. And then he takes his trusty Farman, which is the one that he can drive. He can fly quite slowly, can do bombing with it. And it's at this point that he's at this point in his life, he's really aware of, he's a bit of a futurist, he's really aware of aviation is going to be big, and it's going to really have to play a part in the theatre of war. And our government really needs to take it seriously. And he's actually asked to fly a propaganda flight, really, for the USAR, the new aeronautical reserve that's been set up by John Ryan. And that's what then results in his other stunt, where he lands outside the White House. Quite a feat. He flies from Benning Racecourse over the Capitol, flies around the monument, lands literally in Executive Avenue, which is about 40 foot wide, and his Farman is over 30 foot wide. So it's an incredible feat.
Amazing.
Meets with Admiral Dewey, has lunch with them. It's made a point, you know, look, aircraft can get pretty much anywhere. And he's already made that point in England, and possibly made himself a few enemies in the Admiralty, because he's buzzed the fleet in July 1910. So he comes back with this huge amount of experience of what a professional flying meet looks like, how you can set it up, lots of information, lots of supporters, huge publicity, and then a big wadge of money, well over £100,000 at that point.
Wow.
Because he's been charging for everything, flights, passenger flights, interviews, you know, meets. He's won lots of big prizes. He's won the Gordon Bennett Prize for Britain back from the Americans. So he comes back really probably the world's most famous aviator at that point.
Yeah.
And that's then gives him the ability to set up Hendon, both from a knowledge base point of view and also the funds.
So it's quite difficult for us today to appreciate just how much early aviators took the public imagination by storm. What sort of crowd numbers did Claude attract to his demonstration flights and to his Hendon air shows that eventually evolved to?
Tens and tens of thousands. In Boston, they were regularly hundreds of thousands of people, because there was the flying field sort of stuck out into Boston Harbor. So there were people on boats, there were people on the other side of the harbor. And then when he comes back to England, regularly tens of thousands of people. And if he's there, he guarantees that the gate will increase to a certain level just for him. In Hendon itself, they regularly had thousands, if not tens of thousands, to the point that it became almost a nuisance for people living nearby, these crowds of people. I know at one point, I think it was calculated that Hendon had over a million people attend various meets there. I mean, they did amazing things like flying meets at night with aircraft with light bulbs on them all lit up.
Yeah, he was really innovative, wasn't he, in things like that.
And they did bombing, they did the first aerial first mail service in England from there. There were lots of first parachute jump from a moving aircraft, that kind of thing.
Okay, and I want to come back to Hendon just after this, but just one other question on those displays. Some of the old photographs pre-World War One show, in effect, a flight line, cars parked behind it and that sort of thing. How much of a scene setter was he in terms of what we see today? It's almost like the format of an international air show we see today. Was he that innovative and scene setting that he in effect set the format for us today right through?
Yeah, I think he did. I mean, I don't think he totally takes credit for it. I think what he was very good at was going somewhere else and collating what worked and looking at stuff and being curious. And I think a lot of what he set up at Hendon, he learned at Boston. He learned from the Americans, who at the time obviously were this great motoring country. And in fact, the chairman of Harvard was a guy called Glidden, and he was famous for his promotion of the motor car in America, where he did these tours around America in a car and went, look, this is a car, it's great. And very reminiscent of the Wake Up England tours that Claude did, but this time in an aircraft. So so he specifically noticed that there was a special place for cars at Harvard and obviously brought that idea back.
Yeah.
And so he had this specific place where you could sit in your car and just the refreshments and everything he set up. Even the watchtower that was built above his office has been credited with possibly being an influence on control towers in airports all over the world in one architecture book, I note. He definitely had an impact, and it was called the Hendon Habit. It was part of the social scene. You did Ascot, but you also did Hendon, and he was very clever at promoting commercializing aviation in that way. He was superb at it.
But there was the commercial side, but there was also the threat of imminent war, and He joined the Royal Naval Air Service for a short time, didn't he? Was it just before the start of the war?
Just after it started, yes.
Just after it started, okay.
Yeah, he did not have a good war. And it really wasn't a good idea for him to do that. I think he might have done it out of pride, you know, because he was quite old by then. He was in his late 30s, early 40s. And he just... he had Hendon, he handed Hendon over to the government and didn't set up any kind of compensation arrangement, but just went, you know, it's my patriotic duty. And was probably a bit annoyed when they handed the conduct of Hendon over to Lieutenant Port and not to Claude. And that may have been why he joined up, was like, oh, I better be a man. And then they can give me, you know, I'll be in charge, but I'll be in charge in a uniform. And it didn't work out that way. And he had all sorts of problems during the war with his flying school and having to deal with the army. And it probably troubled him that he was training all these tens of boys that were going and were not lasting very long. And he was training them. He was basically, his schools were sending them to their death. He then had the stress his marriage was breaking down. And then, of course, he was a manufacturer and was one of the major manufacturers. They did actually manufacture the de Havilland and license, but he had lots of frustrations with bureaucracy. He never really worked well with people that were sticking to rules that didn't make sense to him, and was constantly complaining about them changing the plans and then them telling him off for being late. And there's quite a lot about that and a very long letter to Churchill complaining in 1918 about it. So, yeah, the war was not comfortable. And I think eventually he decided, I can't do this. And he resigned his commission after having ditched being in one of the first wave of bombers going across to Belgium. He ditches and is thankfully saved by a French minesweeper, and that may well have brought his idea that, I'm probably more valuable as a manufacturer than I am at doing this. And then, of course, he loses Richard Gates, his long-term manager and friend, who dies in an air crash after an air raid flight. So, it's not a happy time for him, the war.
No, and the war ends, and he feels he's ready to take Hendon, his land, and the airfield back. But the government seemed to have other ideas.
Well, they seem rather reluctant to give it back, and he's sort of very frustrated because they've cancelled all the war contracts. And actually, he said, well, hang on a minute, what am I supposed to do with my people? And they just said, well, lay them off. I mean, they're quite brutal, as everybody knows. They demolish the aviation industry with a pen stroke. And he then is focusing on filling his factories with something else that his chaffs can do. A lot of the other manufacturers do something similar. You know, they sort of change their hangars into mushroom growing places and make other things. So he moves into car manufacturing, which is obviously something he knows a bit about, and creates a new affordable car called the Buckboard, of which there are two existing in the world to this day. In fact, one guy in England has got one, and he drives around. Yeah, it's a funny little car. And then furniture. And by the beginning of 1920, through his incredible efforts and work ethic, he's got his factories up and running again. And the government is still vacillating on what they're going to do. Are they going to carry on? And he's not averse to them having an RAF base there at all. He's the one that's been talking about having aerial defence bases since 1910. So he doesn't want them to, he's quite happy for them to rent a bit, but they just can't make their mind up what they want to do. And in the meantime, his debt, which is quite considerable, is £320,000, gets passed over to the Treasury from the War Ministry, as all debts are. And he's got this, you know, he's got them starting to breathe down his neck. But at the beginning, they're very conciliatory because he's an aviation pioneer and they respect that and they want to treat him well. And they offer him, they say, OK, give us 120,000 and we're all straight. But because he's had no income for a while and then he's had to build things up and reinvest, he doesn't have that kind of money. So he's saying, I don't have that cash. I can give you this much. And they're sort of going, well, you know, we need this. And then it sort of drifts for a bit longer. And then...
And was Hendon, the actual airfield itself, was that not felt that they could settle some sort of quid pro quo for the airfield versus some of his debts? Or where was that? He seems to be at this point, again, from my reading of what was going on, making more enemies than friends, not meaning to, but the situation was taking over rather than the logic of settling this whole issue fairly.
Well, it does start like that. And a guy called Sir Sigmund Dannreuther, he does sort of start to say, I don't really think we're treating this gentleman well. He is an aviator pioneer. But then what happens is, in the meantime, Trenchard has obviously been given this task to create a modern air force with no money. And he probably sees it as an opportunity to get something for nothing. And that's their initial approach is, we'll even sort of organise it so Claude, so the Grey and White Company actually pay us. You know, their view is, yeah. And so they serve a notice on him to say, you owe us this money, here's formal notice. And he, in the meantime, still thinks he can come to some arrangement with the government. And he feels that way really up until the end. But what's happening is in the actual documentation, the legal files, which I've been through, it's quite obvious that they're saying one thing to him. But in the background, Trenchard is agitating for, yeah, I want this. We need this. We cannot, as a government, literally replicate this anywhere else. It's so well located next to London, you know, 10 miles outside of Marble Arch, as Claude used to say. So they're sort of agitating and plotting, really, as to how can we get this for nothing? And, you know, quite brutal, really. And they sort of decide, in the meantime, Claude's just carrying on. He goes off to America in December 1923 because one of the things he does do is he becomes a distributor for a speedboat from America, and he's also trying to get contracts for aircraft. And the government decide to put in the receiver because they feel that they see an advert in the Evening Standard that Claude's put in to say, I'm very close to negotiating the sale of a factory for £250,000, which means that he could pay off his debt. And they want their cake and eat it. They're quite fully decided, but they're kind of erring towards, yeah, we want Hendon. So they panic and they appoint a receiver while Claude's in America, who goes on site, kicks all the thousands of staff, tells them to leave, locks up the factories, locks up Claude's private office, and the won't even let the manager in to take anything. The manager telegrams Claude to say, oh my God, they've done this. I can't get back on site. And Claude comes back to the UK, and it is literally the last time he's never really allowed again on site as the owner.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like really quite sad. Yeah.
And that, the, as we all know from times following that, it becomes a government facility, and Claude really never recovers from that, does he? He goes to live abroad, and he really falls from prominence. Yeah, you know, this amazing position he'd had pre-war, you know, the hundreds of thousands of people, the airfield, the displays, the innovation. How did that affect him as a man from what you've been able to research and understand?
He was never the same again. It was acknowledged by his wife that he was terribly hurt, that not only had they disparaged him by, you know, saying, you know, he's not one of us and he's very unscrupulous, and in fact that all the things they were being, they were accusing Claude of being, and they said that they had paid for it and sort of made themselves out to be, look, we've, you know, he's done rather well out of it, thank you very much, but he hadn't really. And he just could not believe that this country he'd been so patriotic about, so concerned about for all these years, had sort of treated him this way. And he had such, he was a real futurist, Claude. He was somebody always looking to the next thing, and he had really big plans for aviation, utilising Hendon as a base. He'd really put his heart and soul into it, and an awful lot of money. And all of a sudden his future kind of gets taken away from him. He has no future. And it's just not the same. Aviation was his passion. And although he sort of dabbles a little bit afterwards, his heart's not really in it. By now he's in his 50s, and he just is never really acknowledged even after it. There's a photo of him with the Duke of Edinburgh and the Queen, and it's not acknowledging him as a great aviator, it's acknowledging him as a member of the RAC, founding member. You know, this was a man that had the 3 gold medals of the aero clubs of France, Britain and America. Nobody has that. Nobody has ever had that. And he just never received official recognition of what he had contributed. And I just feel there's sort of almost like an institutional forgetfulness about him. Like there's kind of like, yeah, they've parked him because that was a bit of an unsavoury chapter. And if you look at the file, you can see the government doesn't look so nice in that chapter. They actually at one point mislead the Duke of Bedford just to get their way, and it's all in the paperwork. And so, yeah, I just feel even to this day there's this PR about him, and I do wonder if it's sort of prompted from that period of, yeah, he's persona non grata, and isn't this wonderful? We've got this lovely RAF base, which ultimately now is the RAF Museum, who do a wonderful job of talking about him and so on. But I think there's still people today who don't really fully appreciate what he did, because he's kind of almost been written out the story, and I find that a bit of a shame.
Well, that's why we need the book. But before I wrap up and let you go, he was one of Britain's most prominent flyers in the year before, you know, the years before World War One. What do you think had happened if he'd have maintained that sort of presence into war? Do you think he would have become one of those major captains of UK aviation industry, you know, like de Havilland, the Short Brothers, Handley Page? Do you think he would have maintained that presence and grown to being one of those captains of the aviation sector?
I think that's really hard to say. I think the economic climate was so difficult. But having said that, he's very resourceful. He, you know, he was not new. He was definitely an entrepreneur. I think he would have found a way to develop Hendon into something. I don't think it would have been the London airport, because the site was still quite constrained, as the RAF noticed when they were interested in it. But I think it would have been an important place, and he would have moved for the times. I think if he was around today, he would be running a podcast. He'd have a podcast, you know.
It's a bit of the influencer, social media influencer, probably.
Also somebody with this ability to really wind people up. I mean, he was a bit of an Elon Musk. I think he was a bit divisive sometimes, put his foot in it. It's very hard to say, but he would have done something very innovative. You know, he brought a lot of innovation. He was actually involved in the first photo booths. Would you credit it after
didn't
the
know that. No.
Yes, he got it was an American company that created it, and he brought them over from America, and a Russian guy that invented them, I think. So he was involved in that. He was somebody that was talking about we should have multi-story car parks. He was talking about that after the war, that the traffic was a problem. He was always looking forward, and he was very good on infrastructure. He was very interested in things like that. He set up what became Victoria Bus Station. That was his project. So Who knows? Yeah. It would have been innovative and modern and fresh.
And where did his life go? Where did he finish his life? Where did his life journey end?
He finished in the south of France, where he had one of the largest privately owned yachts at the time, motor yachts. And he would sort of sail around the Mediterranean and just had this nice life of he was in Tatler a lot, so sort of a lot of society dinners and things like that. And so his wife, Phoebe, was a bit of a social climber. Her background was she's a Ziegfeld Follie, and in fact was described as a bit of a gold digger, which even her living relative said to me, yeah, she was a gold digger. So she was a bit of a character. Three American wives. Wow. He just sort of lived. He was still very active till the end, driving, and still had companies he was involved in. So, living nicely in the south of France, and died, left a pretty nice wad of money to Phoebe. And then she brought him back to London, and he's buried in Golders Green Cemetery.
Oh, okay. So, Alison, how would you look back on Claude? How would you sum up the impact that he had on not only the British aviation industry, but on the aviation industry as a whole?
I think he was very influential. If you look at the biographies of an awful lot of very famous pilots, very often they trained in the Claude White Flying School. So he was very influential there. I think he was incredibly influential with the ideas he had about aviation and how to promote it. He was an entertainer. He was a propagandist. But he was also an engineer. And I think any engineering innovation, it needs the propagandist as well as the pure engineers. If you think of Steve Jobs and Wozniak and how Apple came about, you know, you need those people. And he was most definitely incredibly skilled and able to sort of push himself outside of his comfort zone into new areas and learn new things and just sort of add this knowledge to who he was. I don't think Hendon Aerodrome would have been anywhere near as successful as it was and influential as it was without him. He had this perfect collection of life experiences, which I talk about in the book, that all contributed to somebody who went, this is what it needs to look like. This is what we need. And a lot of what he predicted and said and agitated about became the reality. So, you know, he was, like I say, this incredibly insightful futurist.
Well, the book's coming to the end of your stage. When can we expect to see the book getting published, Alison?
So the book should be out next year, 2025. Right.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping to do a launch at the RAF Museum. They're really supportive. They've been really fantastic and such a great organisation. Well worth a visit. So much fun. I'm really looking forward to getting it finished because I already have my next book in my head. So,
all right. Okay. Dare we ask what, or is it a secret?
It's called The Compass Adjuster. And it will be based in the marine world. So I've gone from the aviation world to the marine navigation world. So I'll be spending a lot of time at Greenwich. Okay. And another understated, underappreciated character is at the heart of it. So it'll be hopefully quite interesting.
Intriguing. Alison, where can we find you online? Can we follow you on social media or connect up with you? Where can listeners follow this progress?
I'm on Facebook, so you can find me on Facebook. And I am sort of probably going to set up a website because there's lots of things that I've found in my research that I want to kind of signpost people to that are so great, like videos, newly colorized video of Claude and the bonkers gentleman with the car, the buckboard car, who's just has got these videos on YouTube that are just amazing. So, yes, but initially on Facebook, you can find me.
Okay, we'll put links to you in the show notes. That's it. We'd love to thank Mick Oakey, the aviation historian, for introducing us to Alison and telling us a little bit about the story coming to air. So appreciate that, Mick. Thanks very much. And of course, we also appreciate Mick's ongoing support. We'd also like to thank White Hearts for our music, of course. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on social media, and you can find Ellie, Tim and Gareth on the extended social feeds on Instagram, Facebook, Threads and Twitter X. That's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from Alison.
Hi, thanks for listening.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons licence.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our programme and broaden its reach. You can also review the programme and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended.
Extended.
This is XTP Media.